Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Tonight is Studs Terkel Night at the Poetry Center. We're lucky to have him. The city is lucky to have him because he represents the best this town has to offer. In a way, I think we can all pat ourselves on the back because I don't think any other city in America would have produced Studs Terkel if a city can be said to produce a person, although Studs is famous worldwide. He's been many things, an actor, disc jockey, film narrator, TV personality, and much more, and part of that more has been, Studs has been a friend of the Poetry Center these many years. But his fame grows chiefly from his 41 years at WFMT, Chicago's remarkable fine arts station, where he's conducted five nights a week the Peabody Award-winning Studs Terkel Show. As you all know, on this great show, Studs turned the interview into an art form. And these interviews have grown into no fewer than 10 books. Some of them have become classics. Studs' books include Division Street America, Hard Times, an oral history of the Great Depression, Working, People Talk About What They Do All Day and How They Feel About It, and American Dreams Lost and Found. Working and American Dreams were both nominated for the National Book Award, and The Good War, an oral history of World War II, won the Pulitzer Prize in General Nonfiction in 1985. These books were followed by The Great Divide and by Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession, Studs' most recent book, published in 1992. Tucked among these famous titles is a marvelously entertaining memoir, Talking to Myself. We're going to hear from some of these books, possibly from Talking to Myself, believe it or not, an 11th book, which will be published in September. It's called Coming of Age, and it's about creativity in old age. Seated at Studs' left is Liesl Mueller, quite simply one of the best poets. Studs' right? I never think of the right and Studs in the same...
Everybody's my right.
Yeah, that's right, Studs. Studs, I never think of you, in that other direction. Or me either. Is Liesl Mueller. Quite simply, Liesl is one of the best poets in the country. She is the author of four wonderful books of poems, one of which won the American Book Award, which was what they were calling the National Book Award in those days, plus a fine book of translations. She and Studs are old friends. She has been on Studs' show several times, and to add to our celebration of him, she's going to read a poem that has a connection with Studs, and anything Liesl wants to do is more than okay by us. She will read first and tell a little bit about that connection. And incidentally, Liesl is one of the founders of the Poetry Center and is currently on our board of advisors. Liesl?
Can you hear me in this little mic? Okay. Actually, I think Studs is the reason I'm not on his right. I've remained on the left all this time. Or one of the reasons. We all have heroes, and sometimes heroes change for us over time. But Studs has been a hero for me now for 35 years, ever since I first discovered his program on WFMT in 1960. At the time, I was a young mother at home. We had recently moved to the rural outskirts of Libertyville, which seemed much more remote at that time than it does now. And I felt very cut off from the world. Studs' program became my lifeline to the world. Every morning from 10 to 11, which is the time the program was on at that time, I heard Studs and his guests talk about things that really mattered in the world and things that were important in people's lives. His guests were sometimes famous, often not particularly famous, but invariably they were people with imagination and conviction and dedication to whatever they were doing. And whatever they were doing was always something worthwhile and important to all of us. Never anything trivial, because Studs did not cotton to trivia. Never has. That's why he never had celebrity interviews. I don't know how he got people. I think we've all wondered how he has gotten people to talk as freely and articulately and wonderfully and relaxedly as they always have on his program. Because he never asks any direct questions of his guests. He just occasionally makes a little remark that is acts as a gentle prod to let them go on with whatever they're talking about, and it works beautifully. I remember hearing the truth about our involvement in the Vietnam War years before the newspapers were able to dare to expose the truth. And I remember hearing grassroots Chicago activists talk about their battle to save their neighborhood, their Near West Side neighborhood, from being torn down because of the projected Eisenhower Expressway. As you know, they lost that battle. And whenever Studs had writers on, he invariably had read the works with care and with understanding. And writers, of course, responded to that with great animation and delight. It's been a long time since I first started listening to Studs, and Studs since then has become world famous. But the program is still going on, and I think that people still respond the same way. A few years ago, I heard a cab driver tell Studs why he listened to him in his cab. He said, "Mr. Turkle, I listen to you because you always tell the truth, and the truth enlightens." I don't think anyone could have said it better. There were times when Studs didn't have any guests, and he usually played music, especially jazz. One of his favorites was Billie Holiday, who was new to me at that time. I became quite fascinated with the haunting quality of her voice. And I wrote a poem, which is really a cluster of feelings that arose in me while listening to her recordings. I dedicated the poem to Studs. It's called "January Afternoon with Billie Holiday." Her voice shifts as if it were light, from chalk to parchment, to oil. I think of the sun this morning, how many knives were flashed through black compliant trees. Now she has aged it with her singing, turned it to milk thinned with water, A poor people's son, enough knowledge to go around. I want to dance, to bend as gradually as a flower, release a ball in slow motion, to follow in the expanding path, to follow in the marvelous path of an expanding jet streak, love's expansive finger across the cheek of the sky. Heaven, I'm in heaven. The foolish old songs were right. The heart does actually ache from trying to push beyond itself, this room, the world, all that can be imagined. Space is not enough space for its sudden immensity. I am not what you think. This is not what I wanted. Desire has no object. It simply happens, rises and floats, lighter than air. But she knows that. Her words, her voice scrapes against the innocent words of the song. Tomorrow is something she remembers. And now if you please welcome Studs Terkel.
Deeply moved by the tribute from Liesl Müller, especially from her, because she is one of the hidden treasures of our city, of our country, and how she hasn't won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry is still a mystery that escapes me. I remember one of her poems, just to continue, one of her poems in her collection called The Need to Hold Still is about Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein. And that long poem is a drama, it's almost a saga, it's a ballad, it's about womanhood as I've never heard described or poeticized before. It's quite remarkable. It's powerful, it's bitter, it's eloquent, but mostly it soars, and as Liesl, for you, it's truth. And so anyway, thank you very much. And that made my day. What almost ruined my day was a call I received from a member of the press this morning, and it's called me back. He says it's important. So I think maybe it's about the National Labor Relations Board deciding in favor of the baseball players against the owners. And you have a pretty good hunch where I stand on that matter. I thought maybe it's about some of the companies hiring scabs as permanent replacement for striking workers. And I'm ready to say we're the only industrialized country in the world where there would not be a general strike the next day. I'm thinking maybe it's about the attitude of the CIA toward Aristide in Haiti. The question is, what do you think Michael Jordan will do today? My answer was a simple one. I think he would experience a bowel movement today. So he replies, that is not what I had in mind. So I replied, it is what I have in mind now. The fact is, as you grow older, if I may be clinical for a moment, you experience many movements, the peace movement, the civil rights movement, but there are others as well. Now, when I was younger, I, among the great majority of the population, would say when asked the question, what is the most revolutionary invention in the history of the human species? Invariably, the answer would be the wheel. And the spiritual Ezekiel saw the wheel way up in the middle of the sky. It's no accident. I would say indoor plumbing. Which leads to a story. By this, it's all connected with the books in one way or another. writings. And might I add, I was about to say bottom-up history, but the fact is, it is bottom-up history in that you try, Liesl was pointing out that many of my guests are celebrated for their skills and artistry, but a great many, and certainly as far as the books are concerned, are non-celebrated people. In fact, in the audience tonight is the greatest of all British interviewers, Tony Parker, who happens to be in Chicago for a couple of weeks. His approach is very, we are different individuals, but his approach, his basic approach, is similar to mine, in that we seek to find the extraordinary in ordinary people. And so I found myself, this is not connected with that phone call, and so I found myself on the way, my wife and I, on the way to Mongolia, to China first, guests of the Chinese Writers Association. About 14 years ago, the crazy cultural revolution had just come to an end. And while in Beijing, they knew, one of the writers knew, that I wanted to meet a barefoot doctor. Now, a barefoot doctor is one of the phenomena that came into being during the early days of Mao. That is, every village would have a barefoot doctor, not necessarily MD, they couldn't have that many, who would be up on folk medicine, but as well as contemporary drugs and be able to set bones as well. And so someone said, there's someone you want to see way, way up in the grasslands of Mongolia. So there's a 15-hour trip by train from Beijing to Huyahut, the capital of Mongolia, 15 hours. What's interesting is it leaves on time and arrives on time. And I was thinking about that in contrast to the most advanced industrialized country in the world, the United States, and how the trains do not arrive on time. And so there it is. So we're in Huyahut on the way to take a jeep to go to the grasslands way up to see this barefoot doctor. But while in Huyahut, and this is where the tricks of life come into being, my hope was to have a barefoot doctor in the book, but turned out not to be the case, because in Huyahut, there's a school, like the Old Town School of Folk Music here, only 100 times bigger. And this is Mongolia now, Inner Mongolia. And so many of the students are there, but there's the old, old man, Mr. Gawa. He is the bard of all Mongolia, the founder of this school. And he plays something called a hu, a four-string hu, H-U, horse. Horses, you know, are big in Mongolia. And he plays the hu. And as he plays, he tells a story. And it's a story about the birth of the Mongolian people, about Genghis Khan, found along the brook, along the river, much as the Moses bulrushes story is. And it goes on, it can go on for hours, but it haunts you because of this instrument. And then he says, let me tell you how this instrument came to be. Centuries ago, there was a little foal. The mare died, and the little foal is all bones, just bones and skin, starving to death on the green, on the grass. A poor little peasant boy sees him, nurses this foal. The foal grows into be a sturdy little colt, and the peasant boy is growing with it, and finally becomes the golden stallion, known all over Mongolia. And on a stride on that is always this young peasant rider, known all over Mongolia. But the prince, there's the prince with 50 concubines and all sorts of gold, but bored with life. He wants that stallion. And he gives the boy, promises the boy, 12 of his favorite concubines, half the empire. The boy says, no, he will not part with the golden stallion. So naturally, the prince orders his men to knock the boy off the horse. They kick him off. The prince is going to stride that horse. But he doesn't consider the golden stallion who's looking up to see who's riding him. It's not the boy. It's the spoiled prince. And so the crowd, tens of thousands, gathered in the square to see this great moment of ceremony as the prince comes on the golden stallion and the horse just looks at him and just bleats and he throws that prince right into the dirty ditch. And the crowd goes crazy with laughter. And the prince says, we got to kill that horse. Kill him now and cut him into pieces. And so they do. They cut the horse's head off. Remember, the instrument is called a hu, a horse, a four-string hu. Cut the head off. The body is one. Cut the tail off. Three parts. And the young peasant comes to grieve. and to mourn and to weep uncontrollably over his beloved stallion now dead. But the spirit of the stallion speaks up and says, I'm not dead, not while you're here. Sew me up, sew my head to the body, and take my tail and make them the strings of the bow. And every time you play that who, I sing with you forever. And so that's the old man telling that story. And I got to remember that one. I hadn't planned to see this guy. So we go further now to meet that barefoot doctor across the grasslands. Now, this is 14 years ago, and very few white people there. We're on the jeep, my wife and I, and Dai Ching, a writer in China, friend of ours, as well as a Chinese translator and a Mongolian translator. Now, the people are in the village to see these strange long noses. So they put their nose up to mine just like this, to the mic, and they look at it, and they howl, and they laugh at me. That's all I needed. So I do Jimmy Durante. I do Charlie Chaplin. And they're howling. This is great. And finally, we get to the barefoot doctor, and he's a pretty dull guy. And there's nothing much. No, I'm just taking care of all the translation and everything else. He's a pretty dull guy, and it wasn't much. But what do I remember? What I hadn't planned. I remember the old man, Mr. Gawa, and the who. And so this is the way it works. But the important thing is not that. It was the impulse to see the barefoot doctor. What is it like, whether it's Tony Parker or me? I think our goal is, what is it like for someone not celebrated to live at a certain place, at a certain time, under certain circumstances? And so the hard times, the depression, is what is it like to be the carpenter who just came home with a tool chest on his shoulder, or his wife, or his little son, or a businessman having a hard time? What is it like to be a New Deal guy in Washington? And you start thinking about the books and what's happening to us and our memory to the country itself. And so you hear the talks about big government. We got to cut them down and down and down and neuterize it good or Newtonize it good. Got to do that, big government. Their butts were saved by big government, that of their fathers back in the 30s. Dixon, Illinois, the hometown of Ronnie Reagan, was saved by the WPA. Where would Bob Dole be today without the farmer payments and parity? So this is what it's about. There's a loss. And so the young, in a sense, experience it too, not knowing any better through no fault of their own. So at the moment, we may be suffering, I think, from a national Alzheimer's disease. It is that, because there is no memory of past. So the books, in a sense, are about not only now, but about then, reflecting on now. And so the good war, naturally the good war is in quotes, because there ain't no such animal. And of course, Tony Parker was more courageous than I. He was a conscientious objector during the last war. But the good war, World War II, that is good because anything in contrast to Vietnam had to be good, you know. So in a sense, who are these people? What's it like? It seems to me that Bertolt Brecht said it for all of us who engage in this particular trade. That's what a friend of mine, a great British journalist named James Cameron, called his work, a trade, a craft. Bertolt Brecht said, you know, when the question comes up, we hear, who built the pyramids? Immediately we will say the pharaohs. You know, the pharaohs didn't lift a finger. You know that Mrs. Pharaoh's fingernails were as immaculate as Elizabeth Taylor's as Cleopatra. We know that. Anonymous slaves built the pyramids, thousands and thousands of thousands. So Brecht's poem goes, who built the seven gates of Thebes? He says, when Caesar conquered Gaul, we all got this in Latin 1, Caesar's commentaries, all Gaul divided into three parts. When Caesar conquered Gaul, was there not even a cook in the army? When the Chinese wall was built, where did the masons go for lunch? When the Armada sank, and who doesn't know the date? I still remember 1588, of course. Sir Francis Drake conquered the Spanish Armada. He did. What, by himself? Sir Francis Drake, you mean with a feather in his cap and a garter in his knee, conquered the Spanish Armada all by himself? Sir Francis Drake. And so the poem of Brecht is, when the Armada sank, we read that King Philip of Spain, wept. So Brecht's question is, were there no other tears? Well, that's what this is about, the quest called oral history. Oral history itself is a misnomer. Jesus, something new. Oral history preceded the written word by millennia. Remember when Alex Haley was writing Roots, he went to visit the land of his ancestors, Gambia in West Africa, and there he met griots, G-R-I-O-T-S, griots, storytellers. Well, there are still in some societies storytellers, and here too we know there are festivals, stories. There were storytellers from father to son and mother to daughter through the years. Then came the printing press. Then came Gutenberg. And during the WPA, again I return to those quite remarkable days of the New Deal, big government stepping in. During the New Deal, there was the Arts Project, and that included Theater Project, Orson Welles and John Houseman doing the Black Macbeth, Living Newspaper, a new invention. There was the Arts Project. Many of the finest artists came out of that. And I was on the Writers Project. That's how I became a writer. And many of the writers, especially at the South, were doing oral history. Zora Neale Hurston, who's now being rediscovered again, was on the Florida Writers Project. And she was recording the words of ex-slaves. There were still ex-slaves alive. It was 1935. And here in Chicago, people were recording the words of old railroad men, and there were books called Treasure of American Folklore. So nothing. However, along comes the tape recorder. So in a sense, that helped speed and revive the idea of oral history. The irony about me and the tape recorder is I am absolutely inept when it comes to mechanics. I can't drive a car. I can't roller skate. I can't ride a bike. And I goof up on the tape recorder. It's my right arm. Some people say, Studs, you're a poet with the tape recorder. I haven't the vaguest idea how the hell the damn thing works. And sometimes I goof up. And so the person I'm interviewing, who has never been interviewed before, sees, because anybody is better than I am, sees that the reel isn't working when there were reels, or the cassette isn't moving, it's not moving. I say, I goofed up. And so they help me. So when they help you, they, or the other person, feels needed by me. And to feel needed is terribly important to everybody. My ineptitude becomes my asset. So my own vulnerability becomes my ally. Now, so we start thinking about what is it like to live at a certain time, at a certain place. So the book Working opens with Frank, a guy named Mike Lefevre, I call him. Who is Mike Lefevre? He's a laborer in a steel plant, and he's bitter about life because he won't be remembered by anybody. His work is of no meaning, so once in a while, he will do something, a sort of sabotage, mildly. He will take that hammer, and he will smack a dent in the iron ingot to say, that's my dent. And so his dream is someday to walk down, say, Michigan Boulevard or any big street in the city, and he sees the John Hancock Building. And I'd like to see, as I walk with my six-year-old son, a strip of steel from the top story to the bottom. As this day, you know, when the building is finished along the keystone, is the name of the architect. But I'd like to see a strip of steel from the top story to the bottom. And on that strip of steel, the name of every iron worker, of every carpenter, of every scrub woman, of every secretary, every elevator operator. And so when I point to the 42nd floor, I could tell my kid, I put that iron beam on there, that's mine. A person, a man, he said, could be a woman, has to have something to point to. I think having to have something to point to. And so Carl Murray Bates is a guy I met along the Ohio River, a little town called Newburgh, Indiana, near Evansville. And he's at a bar, and I'm at a bar, and Carl Murray Bates is drinking a lot, but he's bragging about his work. He's a stonemason who works by himself on small things. And he says there's a wall somewhere in Ohio that I built a wall to a small house. That wall has all kinds of stones and rocks in it, but it's great. However, one stone is out of place, and I'm the only one who knows it since I built it. He speaks of it so proudly. But then there's a guy who gets tired of his work. You know what a gas meter reader is. You run to a gas meter reader. He comes to the house with a flashlight, goes into the basement to read the gas meter. What's this guy thinking of? Well, this particular guy called Conrad says, well, the work is interesting, but mostly it concerns dogs and women. He says, and the first is reality. The second is fantasy. And he says, well, let's talk about dogs first, I say. He's the dogs. You come in, and suddenly a little dog, a little poodle, is yiping at me and tearing at my leg. So I take out my flashlight to smack him just to protect my woman. What are you doing to my little dog? I said, lady, he's biting my leg off. She's that all? And he's, so that's what, so sometimes as she leads me down the stairs, I follow her, the little poodle is between us. I just give it a swift kick like W.C. Fields would do to make up for the one I missed before. So now I say, what about women? He said, well, nothing's happened, but in my mind, it may. You see, especially in the summertime, and some of those suburbs on the North Shore, some of the young housewives, they're taking a sun bath, and they're lying on a blanket, and they lie on their stomach on the blanket in a bikini, and sometimes they loosen the bra. I don't see, they loosen the bra because they're lying on the stomach. So I creep up very, very slowly. When I'm near, I say, gas man, and she turns around. He says, you know, I get bawled out an awful lot, but it makes the day go faster. And I think that's it. It makes the day go faster. And, of course, there are those who find great pride in their work. Even the work may be dull. The waitress, Dolores Dante, says, when I'm a waitress, I've got to be good at it. I know some people want to demean me, and sometimes I'm a pretty good talker. And some of the guys look at me and say, gee, you're pretty good. How come you're just a waitress? And she says, just a waitress? I mean, you don't think you're good enough to be served by me, is that it? And, of course, that's Dolores. No one could put her down. And then there's the parking lot attendant, Lovin' Al Palmier. He's about 5 feet tall, like Jimmy Rushing, the blues singer, Mr. 5x5. And he says, when I drive that car in that hole, it's one shot, Al. Now, I give everybody good service. You know, the regulars get special. The others who don't give me a tip, I give them service, but it's not soigné. And so you have that. And, of course, there's the fireman who finds in his work what it's all about. Tommy Gates, the fireman. He says, I've done everything. You know, I've done work at a bank. I've been with papers. It's all effed up, he says. That word, all fucked up, that is used so often, is what got the book in trouble, by the way, working itself, because I love Tommy Gates so much. I used part of his quote in the preface, and that caused a big problem. In an industrial working class town near Erie, Pennsylvania, which is a story in itself. We can talk about censorship, perhaps, during question. I hope we'll have question-answer time. You can ask me anything. If I don't know the answer, I'll fake it. That's an old disc jockey phrase. I still call myself a disc jockey. So there's, well, what is it like to work at a certain trade at a certain time? Oh, so Tommy Gates, the fireman, says, all this stuff is all effed up, our lives are. But a fireman delivers. You see him carry a baby out. You see him breathe in the mouth of a stranger who's dying, black or white, this guy, this being, this woman. And you're breathing into her, into him. Suddenly there's life if we succeed. Well, that to me, maybe, and then I end the book with a phrase that he uses. You can never can lose when you use the phrase of the person. He says, maybe that's what I am on earth for. And so that's the nature of work in that. And then in the Depression book, and this will lead into today, you know, the book I'm working on now is called Coming of Age. It's about people 70 and over who are still scrappers one way or another. And coming of age is ironic, because coming of age would ordinarily mean coming to the age of puberty or the age of consent or the age of ability to work. It was also Simone de Beauvoir's book on feminism, Coming of Age, and it was Margaret Mead's book, Coming of Age in Samoa. So I simply call it Coming of Age. And one of the things I've discovered is people have pretty full lives. It's from 70 to a person 99 and 100 years old. And the grieving is not so much for themselves as for those who will follow. They don't see much to the world. Many of them hopeful, but not. And one of the reasons is the loss of memory on the part of a society. And they remember. That's the point. So, for example, in the 30s, as a man named Jose Iglesias in the book Hard Times speaks of a certain strike of cigar makers. Now, you remember, the 30s was the time of the CIO being formed, and there was a beginning of industrial unions. The cigar makers is an old, old union, and most of your Europeans, Italian or Spanish-speaking. So in Ybor City, which is the Spanish-speaking and Italian, at the time speaking, suburb of Tampa, Florida, are the cigar makers. Now, cigar makers, men and women, work together at a long table. They get the same pay. And they work at all kinds of cigars. The fancy ones are called regalias, or regalias, and the other cigars. So they're there in this one place all day, but they're also curious about literature and work. These are working people, mostly from Italy, or from Spain or Latin America. And so they would hire, in the 30s, they hired an actor. The Italians hired an Italian actor. The Latinos hired a Spanish-speaking actor. And they built a platform. And each paid a half a buck a week. And he would read while they rolled the cigars. He'd read Les Miserables, or Three Musketeers, War and Peace. This is the stuff they'd hear in installments. And he also read some radical literature. The owners, who didn't pay a penny, saw this as dangerous. And so they destroyed the platforms. And there were three reader strikes, and the workers lost all three. But what is interesting is Jose Iglesias, who was a writer, used to write the New Yorker once in a while, remembered his grandparents and his mother and his uncle and the feeling they had for that life outside the factory, but also the bitterness toward those who scabbed, carried on for years. And here we have scabs going through. In the old days, even in the worst times, in Henry Ford's worst days, they always went through the back door. Now they go right through, smiling, and sometimes scabbing on the old man. You may remember there was a football player strike, and they had scabs playing football. I decided, because I'm perverse, to watch one of the games. They were horrible. It didn't matter. It was probably Dallas versus Denver. It probably would be Dallas, I'm sure. And the scabs playing, and you got three yahoos, young yahoos in the stands, bare-chested. It's a bitter cold day. Saying, "We love our scabs." That moment, I wasn't rooting for either team. I was rooting for pneumonia. And so we have that today. No memory. So I was waiting. And this I use, I know some of the ads that I promised to read from the forthcoming book, but this stuff is too long to read, so I'll talk about it. In the preface, I describe this scene, just to follow through on what you've just heard. I'm waiting for the bus. It's a community near Uptown. It's a half street in an area of have-nots. And this is a half couple, a young couple and I, waiting for the bus, the morning bus. I've seen them for almost a whole year. We nod at each other, don't say much, nod. And this day, and he has the Wall Street Journal wrapped neatly under his arm, she the latest Vanity Fair, and I got a bundle of everything. And so I want to make conversation now and then, and I'm dressed goofily. And it was a couple of days before Labor Day, this is a few years ago, and I'm saying, "Labor Day coming up," to make conversation. Nothing. They look at me. "Who is this nut?" I say, "You know, that was the day the unions used to march down Michigan Boulevard, down State Street, and celebrate trade unions and labor." Boy, silence. "Boy, those were some days." And silence. And then he says, we loathe unions. So I know I got a couple of pigeons here. I said, just taking a step to him, and now I'm the Ancient Mariner fixing with my glittering eye. I stop with one of two, you know. And then I says, how many hours a day do you work? He said, I beg your pardon? How many hours a day do you work? He's 8 hours a day. How come you don't work 18 hours a day? Your great-grandparents did. And he's looking blank. I said, you know why you're working 8 hours a day? Four guys got hanged for you for the eight-hour day. It was the Haymarket Affair in Chicago, 1886. I didn't expect them to know that, but just a thought. And now I've got them pinned against the mailbox. And he and his young friend with the Vanity Fair are looking out as though for a passing patrol car. You know, and I got him pinned. I says, how many hours a week do you work? And now he's just saying, 40, dead boy, 40. How come you don't work 80 hours a week? I says, don't you know people got their heads busted, men and women back in their 30s fighting with a 40-hour week for you? Well, they finally got on the bus. The bus came finally. Fortuitously, it was late. So the guy, I know one of the drivers named Bob Barry. Maybe it was he with ESP experiencing something. And so they finally got on. I never saw them again. And then sometimes I feel bad because why did I do this? This sweet young all-American couple who did me no harm. And suddenly I felt like Huck Finn on the raft. Remember when Huck was telling the slave chasers, when they asked if that guy on the boat was white or black, he said, white. It was Jim, of course, escaping. And then Huck was saying, well, why? I did a terrible thing, but why do I feel so good? And so I think about this. I did an awful thing, but why do I feel so good? And so this basically is what this is all about, trying to recoup memory, to revere memory. And I was thinking, so I'd like to have questions too, thinking that one more aspect of the works of me, and I say Tony Parker because his work's quite remarkable, is that these ordinary people sometimes are capable of extraordinary things. And so the people in the book who say, I count, is when they take part in some activity. See, one of the sad aspects of our day is, what's the point? We know the voting, the polling, the election turnout is the lowest that's ever been, and it'll be lower and lower and lower. Because what's the point? The guy with the most money to advertise wins. Ironic. In the first democracy in the world, the guy with the most dough wins. And so those, the great many say there's no point. But those stubborn ones, and I have a good number of them in the book, those stubborn ones who do something, whether it be environmental, whether it still be peace, or whether it be stopping a developer, whether it be something, they're doing something, and they realize, I count when there's someone else with them. There are these enclaves, and to me, the hope is in these enclaves, in these people, because one of the guys, a country storekeeper, says, you know, it doesn't take the majority to do it. You know, this American Revolution that occurred, the great many sat by. They didn't get King George or not. The truth is that, he says. But it's these crazy agitators like Sam Adams and the others who did it, turning over that tea, the Boston Tea Party and all. That's part of it. And so in them, there's kind of that spirit that still makes for it. So we have Mary Lou Wolfe in Chicago, mother of nine, who didn't like what the kids were doing in Vietnam, but bit by bit got caught up in a battle involving stopping an expressway. In fact, she became a community leader. But I'll end this part and then read something from a forthcoming book with C.P. Ellis about transcendence and overcoming. C.P. Ellis, someone I met by accident, was the grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan of the city of Durham, North Carolina. I read somewhere in the papers about a man named C.P. Ellis, Claiborne P. Ellis, who had changed and was now touring the country with this black woman, his former enemy, Ann Atwater, a civil rights worker whom he hated as she hated him, traveling around the country talking about integration and about unions. So I finally got to see C.P. Ellis, and his story is a very simple one. He was a poor white. All his life was lousy and rotten and no good, and his father was a poor Klansman who loved him. And by the way, whenever you look down, you see the sheets on these pictures sometimes. Look at the shoes. Hardly any Gucci shoes. They're scuffed shoes, Nazi. The Gucci shoes, guys, use them. That's precisely the point. That's what C.P. Ellis discovered. So he's this poor white. He says, my life's been rotten. It's always been the damn nigger. Always a black guy. He gets it. And bit by bit, his life is rotten. One kid is retarded. He's having a hard time. And then one day, the guy said, why don't you join the Klan? And he explained something. And we have to understand this, what being a member of a Klan is. So they put on the sheet, me, C.P. Ellis, who has no respect for himself, who's nothing. It's in the dark, about 400 people there. There's an illuminated cross, and I'm walking down toward that cross with the hood. Suddenly, I feel I'm somebody. The same phrase Jesse Jackson usually says to black people, you are somebody. Well, the fact is it can be used perversely as well. In this case, I'm somebody, of course, to hate somebody. Somebody better than. And so he becomes that. He becomes a Klan leader. And by this time, the civil rights movement is in effect, and Ann Atwater is there leading them, and they want to kill each other. And one day, Jimmy Carter is president. There's some money comes to Durham for schools, for charrettes, for libraries. And whoever this guy is, a black guy, very bright, knew something about C.P. Ellis. He knew in this man little hints of something there. So one day he says, let's all get together. He invites the White Citizens Council, the SNCC, NAACP, the Klan to come there. And some go, so some say to CPL, you're not going to go with all them blacks. He says, well, I got to go. I got a kid going to school. Why should they get the money? I want some money for my kid too. So there's that meeting. And there's a fury back and forth between C.P. Ellis and the others. And finally, someone says, we've got to have a committee. We've got to continue. Someone nominates Ann Atwater as chairman, chairperson. And then the black chairman says, and I nominate C.P. Ellis as co-chairman. And C.P., as he tells the story, you start laughing. And he starts laughing. He says, what's this guy trying to do to me? I'm going to work with her, never. And I start thinking, wait a minute, if she got all by herself, they'll get all the money. So I'll work with her. So I say to her, you know, we're not friends. And she says, I know that. But we got the one thing, is there truth just about this only? There is. And they start working together on this common cause, their kids. And now they start calling each other by the first names. And then one day she comes in crying. He says, what are you crying about, Ann? He says, well, my little girl was laughed at by the kids at the school. Say, her mother's going around with a Klansman, and they're laughing at her and humiliating her, and she's crying. And suddenly C.P. says, he busts out crying. My kid had the same experience in this white school, that my boy's going around with this black woman agitator, civil rights worker. Suddenly they're embracing each other out of sheer need, and suddenly they're friends. And then C.P. starts thinking, something's cockeyed here. Has Ann Atwater taken my money away? Is she the one? As I walk down the street, I wake up, I see this old black guy shuffling by. Is he the one stealing my money? If he is, why is he so ragged? He says, wait a minute. And then guys used to call him up at night, the mayor and the big shots. C.P., you did well when he broke up a civil rights rally. He would break them up. You doing? Next day, I'm walking down the street, and they see me coming. And he crosses to the other side of the street, not to be seen with me. That's the guy in the Gucci shoes. And then C.P. starts thinking, wait a minute. Whose side am I on? And bit by bit. And so finally, C.P. is working as a janitor at Duke University in Durham. And he's starting to help. Most members of this union, of which he is part, are black women. And so he says he's going to run. And now he's known, C.P., around town for being the strange guy who quit the Klan, for being this guy who goes around with Ann Atwater lecturing about integration, about racial understanding, and about unions, because she's a union person. And so there's a vote. He's going to run for business agent of the union, and he's, I haven't got a chance. I'm going to run against a black man. And the union is 80% black. And so I'm going to run, and he says, I announce to the union, you know who I am, C.P. Ellis. And you know the owners are going to send out the leaflets with me in white robe. You know that. You know I was a, you all know all that. Now I want your vote. And they all holler, we had enough, we had enough. That's all. He thinks he's going to lose. He says, they all holler, we want Ellis. We want Claiborne. He says, I won 90% of the vote. And that's when he starts crying. He says, God damn it, now I know. He says, now I got to get some black kid to replace me because I'm doing other work now. So that's C.P. Ellis' story. So it's about what? It's about redemption. It's about transformation. It's about transcendence. And he's just an ordinary working guy. So that's basically what we try to do. So how are we doing for time? Pretty good? Yeah. Could I just wind up maybe by reading what might have been? And then we'll have questions. Is that all right? This may be too long. This is the afterward. They're reissuing my memoir, Talking to Myself. Maybe I shouldn't, because we want questions, don't we? What's that? Well, let's do, I don't know. You got time for that? All right, okay. Tell you what this is. The memoir, Talking to Myself, concerns a lot of the hotel where I was raised a number of years. The Wells Grand Hotel on Wells and Grand Avenue. It was a men's hotel, quite a good one. And then we sold it, and then it went, and finally it became an SRO. So this is a backward glance, 1995. This is years after the book finishes. They have this year evicted all the guests of the Wells Grand Hotel, the last of the lot. It had become in recent years an SRO. That's one of the few acronyms I can still decipher these days. Single Room Occupancy. It had been a good one. However, the proprietor is going to condo it. And who's to deny him the unalienable right to make a fast buck or two? Single old men and a few old women pay rents that are singularly less than young couples upward bound can put forth. The community had been transformed from a life on the razor's edge neighborhood into a de rigueur enclave. Boutiques, art galleries, restaurants awarded 5 stars by our local Michelins, places to be seen in as well as see. Almost overnight, the ugly duckling became the lovely princess, and it is boomtown. And what the hell is an SRO doing in these parts? The developer has an acutely developed sense of smell and which way the wind is blowing. He needs hold no wet finger in the air. He needs no diving rod. He simply sniffs the air of a neighborhood close to the loop, close to where the action is, close to what is it for the young on the make. And so it's cheerio, Wells Grand. Where will they go? These old ones who still have an independent bone or two. It's a question I ask an enterprising young developer. He languorously waved a Rolexed wrist westward, out there. Out where? The question John Holloway was asking himself. He was the old boy who called me up to break the news. We've got a month to vamoose, he said. He'd been living there long before it went SRO. I feel like one of those Cherokees given the boot by Andy Jackson. John always read a lot, even Matchbox covers. And the last time I ran into him, he had a well-thumbed Nelson Algren paperback in his pocket. Holloway, in his late 80s, was the Wells Grand's historian. I remember him as a young buck turning 20 when I was a boy clerk at the hotel run by my mother. John was forever in the lobby, the chair tipped against the west wall. And as he aged, he took to the scuffed leather armchair. Always he was observing the passing scene, our sardonic narrator. He had seen his country change as well as his hotel, for better and for worse. The euphoria of the 20s, the Great Depression, the New Deal, World War II, the Cold War, and now. His chuckle that had turned dry and phlegmy through the years punctuated his commentary. We're like the Bourbons, kid, learning everything and remembering nothing. At the clerk's desk, where he often asked about mail that seldom came, I thought I heard him say, Wells Grand Hotel where nothing ever happens. It was, of course, the phrase familiar to moviegoers who remembered Grand Hotel. Lewis Stone was the lounger in the lobby, the bitter battle-scarred veteran of World War I, who was echoing John Holloway. Grand Hotel where nothing ever happens. And I always equated the palatial hotel in pre-Hitler Berlin with the Ah Blue Collar Palace. To me, they were both hotels of distinction. In the early 30s, depressed by my experience at law school, I wrote letters of application to New York's Plaza, to Chicago's Drake, and San Francisco's Mark Hopkins. In careful longhand, I offered my précis as clerk at the Wells Grand. If nothing else, I figured the name would impress, and always I received a polite response. After months of such correspondence, I reluctantly abandoned my dream of one day becoming managing director of one such hotel. A fresh boutonniere in my lapel, properly greeting visiting dignitaries, diplomatically holding off the press as they sought out Queen Marie of Romania or Vaclav Nijinsky. The closest I came to Grand Hotel was in the person of Madame Eugenie Leontovich. She created the role of Grushinskaya, the dancer. Garbo's green portrayal of Gru was memorable, but Madame was the genuine article. And I'd become her leading man. Imagine that. In the Chicago production of The Cave Dwellers of Saroyan, she chose me to play the King of the Tramps. She was, of course, the queen. It was the role she created on Broadway. Though I never became the managing director of the Plaza, I embraced the actress who played Grushinskaya, the grandest guest of the Grand Hotel, all 85 pounds of her. Garbo may have had John Barrymore, but Leontovich had me. And there were many paths I could have traveled, and so it goes on about the paths I could have traveled. And so I'll skip all that and go with one little one I could have been. And this is, I was looking for a job. There was the Great Depression, and I'm looking for a civil service job. And one was with the FBI. In 1934, they had a job as a fingerprint classifier paying $14.40 a year. Now, perhaps I should read just this one part and we'll call this a day and then have questions. And so, had John Edgar Hoover been less diffident and less shy, I might have worked for him, the director. It was 1934, one of those years when a 9-to-5 job was devoutly to be wished, especially in the civil service. I took all the exams. By this time, it was clear that lawyering, I went to law school and I loathed it. Lawyering was not for me. So I applied for the job as fingerprint classifier for the Department of Justice, specifically the FBI. I was informed I'd passed the examination with a grade of 88.75. I'd hear from them shortly. Now, thanks to my Freedom of Information files, running to some 200 pages, I came across an exchange of letters between myself and the director. Mine were in a slovenly, though decipherable longhand. His were neatly typed and always signed, Director. Here are some excerpts of the billet doux. January 4th, 1934. This applicant appears to be mentally alert and intelligent. My impression of him is that he's straightforward in manner. I recommend, therefore, he receive favorable consideration. It was signed by M.H. Purvis, Chicago Special Agent in Charge. There was a particular thrill to this one because Melvin Purvis was John Dillinger's bete noir. It was he who did in Public Enemy Number 1 outside the Biograph Theater. January 12, 1934, a memorandum for Mr. Sornberger, appointment clerk from the director. It is requested that letters be prepared appointing the following person, author's note, mine, I and another whose name is blacked out. Very often all these names are blacked out. Effective with entry on duty and payable from appropriations for salaries and expenses. It was CAF 2, $14.40 per annum. Oh, joy, I was in. My dancing on the streets was somewhat premature. There was a January 13th report. The informant's name was blacked out, though pieces of telltale evidence tell me he was a member of the University of Chicago Law School faculty. And here's the quote. While it is true that he worked diligently in his criminal law, I did not consider him any more than an average student. His appearance, in comparison with that of other college students, was somewhat sloppy. And I would not consider him the best type of boy. March 13th, a further memo from the director to Mr. Sawbarger. Louis Turkle, eligible, was not selected for appointment. Informant stated he was not particularly impressive, his appearance was sloppy, and he did not consider him the best type of boy. After the Civil Service Commission informed me that my chances of appointment were uncertain because of little demand, I inquired of the director in a letter of June 13th. I should appreciate a more definite answer from you in light of the information you may possess. I hope you will not consider me too presumptuous. Indeed, the director did regard me as too presumptuous. His response, June 19th, reflected the cool of a sought-after debutante. You are advised that your application will receive consideration when a vacancy occurs wherein your services may be utilized. It began to dawn on me that my name would never appear on the director's dance card. Slightly piqued, I dispatched a letter, September 12th, to the Honorable Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President of the United States. Receipt was acknowledged by Louis McHenry Howe, Secretary to the President. I stated the case, step by tortuous step, with a veiled reference to what I consider the director's dilatory behavior. The letter may have been forwarded to the director because in a response from him, January 10th, 1935, I detected a note of distemper. You are advised that applicants for positions in the Division of Investigation are not advised wherein they fail to meet any requirements set up by the division. So ends this colloquy between myself and the director, nor shall I ever know what course I should have pursued to become the best type of boy. Had the director been more forthcoming, who knows? I might have become Ephraim Zembelis Jr. or Clyde Tolson. And so I thought this is part of the afterword to the book of what I might have been. And so these are various aspects to what I'm doing at the moment.